Hi everyone, my name is Shona Lane. I'm Education Officer here at the Western Plains Cultural Centre. Joining me today are Kent, our curator.
Good afternoon.
Caroline, our assistant curator.
Hello.
Jessica, our collections officer.
Hi.
And Andrew, our manager.
Good day.
Today we'll be focusing on Adaptation, which is the latest exhibition to open in the main gallery space. This exhibition examines the Australian landscape through the works of Louise Hearman and Louise Weaver. Both artists create their own unique vision of the Australian landscape through painting and handcrafted sculptural forms. The first thing I'd like to reflect on is the significance of the title. Pass it to you, Kent, as curator of this exhibition.
Well, Adaptation came about, I suppose, looking at both of the artists' work, there's an element of adaptation in what they do. The work reflects on the Australian environment, and that's not just the physical environment, but also a kind of a metaphysical environment, and changes it or tweaks it slightly, sort of through the eyes of the artist. So in the example of Louise Weaver, she takes elements from nature and creates a new skin for animals, or looks at the world through the lens of craft, I suppose. Louise Hearman takes elements of the real world in her works, and often the works are landscape paintings, paintings of specific aspects of nature, and then inserts these kind of incongruous symbols or objects that change things. So both of them are, I think, affected, like any artist, by the landscape that we live in. And I think they're reflecting upon that and like any artist, adapting what they've looked at and changing it to suit their kind of idiosyncratic worldview.
Okay. That's interesting, but what I want to know, what I want to put forward to the rest of the crew here is, when you first sort of brought up the theme of adaptation, or when you think of adaptation, you normally think of something that's quite utilitarian. You adapt for a particular purpose. You know, you can see, you know, in evolution and so on, you know, or you know, people with their machines, they adapt them to suit particular things. But here, the purpose is often quite hidden, or it seems, you know, for example, there's lots of cats missing their ears and things. What is the point of adapting the cat to not have any ears? I'm interested in what other people see in that.
I don't know that it's necessarily as clear-cut as that, in the sense that she's adapting the cat so that it doesn't have ears, you know, things like that. I think the adaptation is probably more subtle, in the sense that it's a way of helping us as a nation, as a people, kind of come to terms with the landscape that we live in the sense that even today, the greater population of Australia, people who have migrated here, have a unusual relationship with the environment and with the landscape, and it's foreboding and unsettling and strange. So the only ways that we can ever really truly understand it is to kind of alter it and change it to fit other conventions that might exist already in culture. So I think that's what they're doing a lot of the time, that, you know, for example, Louise Weaver is adapting animals so that they're bright and colourful and toy-like, so that we can approach them and understand them and engage with them in that way. So I think the adaptation is not necessarily... I think it has a functional element, in the sense that it's trying to help us as a society kind of come to terms with our landscape and our environment. But I don't necessarily think it's as straightforward as simply them trying to create better kinds of animals, but actually just tinkering around to see what results the adaptation might produce.
It's a big claim that she's helping all of society get used to the environment.
That's what her interest is in. I don't think she's setting out to think, well, I'll change every Australian's opinion about the landscape, but she's fitting in with that narrative that's already in Australian culture about trying to come to terms with a landscape that's unfamiliar, unusual, kind of unnatural to what we understand a landscape should be. So I think that she's very much, she may not look like it, but I think Louise Weaver and Louise Hearman are both very much part of that tradition of Australian landscape art, in the sense of it trying to come to terms with the environment we find ourselves in.
So in that, I think it points to what Kent was saying in terms of it's not about, it's not just about the physical landscape.
Mm.
So, I mean, we're meant to, in a sense, are we meant to look at these images? And not all of them are like this, but the adaptations of, say, the Japanese rice gourd and other things. Are we meant to look at them as to see beyond what that object is to what it is adapted for? Is that part of what perhaps the audience could be looking at?
Yeah,
not
and
to
also
solve a puzzle in a sense,
no.
But there is something else out there that is intriguing about this.
No, I don't think. Yeah, I think you're right. I don't think that this puzzles are solved in her creating a new skin for something. I think she, in some instances, makes it more puzzling. In a sense, with what Weaver does is she, in creating a new skin for something, there's a kind of an attempt to erase the identity of the thing that's being covered and a kind of a new identity forged. But invariably, she can't erase it completely. So we sort of come, I suppose it's a bit like sort of coming up with a third meaning. You know, there's the meaning of the cover, there's the meaning of the object, and then there's a third meaning created by
together,
the combination of
new.
The two. That's right. And I suppose just going back to what we were saying before about adaptation, in some ways I was thinking more in terms of probably a literary perspective or the changing from one state to another. Mm-hmm. So, you know, a book is adapted into a play or a play is adapted into a screenplay. You know, it's taking one thing and communicating it in such a way that it either changes it or opens it up to different interpretation, etc. So I think in her taking objects such as a Japanese rice wine gourd and creating a skin for it, in a sense she's taking it. She's attempting to erase its, you know, its meaning or perceived meaning, and making suggestions of what else it might represent, or turning it into an object, turning it into an art object when before it was a utilitarian kind of object. And for me, those rice wine gourds, which appear throughout her work a fair bit, in some respects to me look like thought bubbles. You know, I suppose our interpretation of them varies, but they do become very special, fetishistic kind of objects.
Okay, well, we thought about adaptation fairly strongly in terms of Louise Weaver's works, and the adaptation is quite obvious in those works. What about in humans?
Well, Louise Human, I think, what I find really beautiful about her work is, and what's, I suppose, most unsettling about her work is that she adapts the world in such a way that you look at her work and, for all intents and purposes, they are beautifully rendered landscapes that we recognise, that we have an emotional reaction to, but there is something within them that changes that. So there's a sort of a subtlety to the way that she adapts the world or the Australian environment in her work that is sort of insidious and less obvious. And really, her practice is influenced by what she sees in the world, the things that she is interested in. So she may see the way the light hits the side of someone's head as she's walking through the streets, and that will make its way into a painting, and that may, you know, become a head floating in the sky, you know, above a landscape. But
I think there's also an element within her works about context and adapting context of things that quite often the elements within her work are recognisable. You have a dog head in the middle of a flower. You recognise the dog's head, you recognise the flower, but you've taken both of those things out of their context and kind of given them a new context. So simply changing where things are positioned and how we recognise things and how we relate to things is a form of adaptation, and it very much like, I mean, I don't think she's a surrealist, but I think she's very much in that tradition of painting things that we recognise, elements that we recognise, but in unusual juxtapositions with other things that we recognise to create whole other levels of meaning. And I think it's not necessarily that she adapts the physical animals in or landscapes within her work, but for my mind, I think it's the fact that she adapts the context in which we recognise them that give their work a unsettling, sort of disturbing nature that we can't quite. Well, is it a flower with a dog in the middle of it, or is it a dog with a flower around it? You can't really decide what is supposed to be the dominant element.
Yeah, and I think also for me, Heumann's work kind of speaks about a kind of an unease with the environment that we've had since settlement. Australia as a continent is extremely diverse, large, which of course had many positives for the colonists, but equally the fear that gripped them in trying to, you know, move inland, I think is still part of the Australian psyche. I think that we, you know, from a bunyip through to a Tasmanian tiger, there's, although some are real and others aren't, there's still this idea that somewhere in the wilderness there could be a Tasmanian tiger still alive. But equally, you know, there could be a bunyip out there as well. And I mean, that's not just an Australian thing, but I think it is very much a part of our psyche. And I think Heumann kind of picks up on that. Her paintings are strangely unsettling, but not horrifying. So in a sense, we can sort of feel comfortable in looking at them, even though they're extremely odd. And I don't think she is a surrealist, I agree. I think that with surrealism, you know where you are. You know that the whole thing is surreal.
A concoction of ideas.
Exactly, yeah. Whereas hers is a lot more subtle. It is just these little tweaks that kind of make you realise that not all is what it seems.
I think it's also important to point out, though, because I'm bang on about the foreboding of the Australian landscape, much as the next bloke, it's one of my favourite topics, but it's the interior.
Yeah.
There's no, and this is, I think, very common in a lot of all sorts of works, literary works or even historical narratives or artworks about our landscape. The sea is not threatening.
No.
Whereas
it's
in Europe,
not.
No.
There's giant big fishes in there that eat people.
Yeah, I know, but it's.
But we've never really obsessed about that. Like,
yeah.
It's never. the ocean has never been much of a threat to us in the same way that it has to the Japanese.
Or even the Europeans, like the European, the storm, storm paintings and stuff. We don't do
that,
I think.
That's true.
We're almost, in a sense, we're sort of sitting on the edge of our continent looking out with great sort of wonderment and awe and joy even. And if we get just that little bit closer, if we swim 10 metres out, I know most of the time we're closer to New Zealand, which is, you know, but, you know, there's a difference. And I think that there's, you know, that sort of part of our landscape is quite an interesting sort of split.
That's
between
right.
What can essentially be, because more people drown at the beach than sort of disappear into the bush, never to be seen again.
Yeah, that's right. And I think, you know, like it came to the fore with, you know, a lot of painters who started looking, and in literature, and people who looked at the lost child in the bush as a kind of a metaphor for, you know, us colonists coming here and
innocence lost in a kind of brutal, harsh environment.
That's right. And I think if you look at a contemporary example like Wolf Creek, where the horror in that film is as much about the landscape, not just the landscape, but the enormity of it. I think that film is quite interesting in the way that it builds upon horror film cliche. And for the first time actually twists it in the sense that the characters in any horror film run away from what they are being threatened by. But in the case of Wolf Creek, they've got nowhere to run. They're kind of running away to get away from something and not realising that they're running into something a lot more disturbing and, you know, frightening.
Like Mad Max.
Yes.
Because Mad Max, remember, his house was at the beach.
Yeah.
And Mad Max 2, when the world has gone to pot, it's nothing but the sparse outback of you know, Burke and Broken Hill.
Yeah.
It's quite, I was going to say something else, but I've completely forgotten. But there's no, there, I reckon there's a historical narrative for that, because you don't see this in American art quite so much, this, their interior paintings that's full of buffalo, there's
opportunity,
fecundity, and so on and so forth. Whereas, because they had organised parties, they went out in groups, in large, you know, wagons circling people, setting up whole townships, setting up whole areas, claiming places. Whereas very often our people were, they were off by themselves. Mm. They were completely isolated from any sort of thing. And so I think there's more opportunity for that fear. Mm.
And also the way that we've sparsely populated the edges of this country. You know, it's east heavy, but essentially there's not enough civilization around the edge of the country to feel that the that whatever bad things are in the interior have been trapped. You know, like if you look at Western Australia, you've got big cities, but you've also got a huge expanse between those big cities.
And you do feel as though if you go to Western Australia that you're having to kind of cross over something
big
and kind of unknown, and sort of, and then you survive when you get there.
Yeah, that's right.
I wonder if the West Australians feel the same when they come over here.
I'm sure they do.
Okay, moving on from there and considering the landscape further, we have Jeff Mincham Ceramics in the Project Space and Children's Gallery at the moment. And this is the fifth in Objects annual series, Living Treasures, Masters of Australian Craft. Kent, can you tell us more about this series, please?
The series focuses on craftspeople who have a long career in their particular medium, and they are recognised for the contribution that they've made not only to their particular area of expertise but also generally. And the exhibition is a way of highlighting their practice. But the show is new work. It's not retrospective. There is a publication that's produced which is a retrospective look at their work, but the exhibition is about their current practice. So it's an interesting program, and something that has been hugely successful in terms of the brief. The shows that have been put on have been, you know, really revelatory in a number of ways in terms of the people that they've exposed to the wider art world, if you like. And in many ways, it probably has done what it set out to do, which is to highlight craft practices and craft practitioners.
Do you think it has, the sort of the whole series of this Living Treasures series, encouraged a coming together of the arts and the crafts, or do you think it's further separated them in the sense of craftspeople are people that we can say you are a master craftsperson? You know, that you are a kind of skilled artisan, you are at the top of your field. Do we make those same claims about artists, and should we or could we?
Well, I think that it's been successful in highlighting craftspeople who have had a tremendous impact on their own area of expertise and developed it and pushed it. For me, I think that it has been successful in ensuring that craftspeople are part of the greater dialogue. Whether or not it's done anything to push craft into the art world proper is debatable.
Mm.
I think that the art world's still very resistant to... But I don't think you could look at the artists that have been... Well, the craftspeople, whichever you want to call them, the artists that have been part of the Living Treasures, and not see their work as incredible. They're artists, really.
Yes.
And so it's probably done a lot in that regard, in terms of taking us away from a kind of homely notion of what craft is into a much more sophisticated. Part of culture generally.
Yes.
I mean, one could argue that it's more closely resembling design, maybe. But I still think that those two areas are just as important in terms of art generally.
But I'm interested in where you're drawing the line between an artist and a craftsperson. How is Jeff Minchin any different from Arthur Boyd? They're both devoted to expressing what they see in the landscape, in inspiring people's appreciation of the landscape. Jeff Minchin was the first living treasure who is a full-time ceramicist. He's been a full-time ceramicist for 30 years. And he approached his project with a feeling of inspiration, returning to his reject pile and building on innovations. And I don't see why there is any line between a craftsperson and an artist.
I think often it comes down to that sense of crafts having a function, and that's admirable and kind of important, but by consequence it's saying that art doesn't have a function. And I think you can very much look at art and craft as all having functions, and in many respects they're all then, for example, the fine arts, photography, are a form of craft if you look at them having a functional element in terms of education and consciousness and emotion and all of those sort of elements.
I think you're right. I think that if anything, it's contributing to a dialogue about why we classify people, why they need to fit into a neat box for the sake of interpretation or whatever. I think that you can look at each of those craftspeople and see them as artists. And maybe it's because, you know, I mean, Boyd also dabbled in pottery. You know, he was an artist who dabbled in, you know, and that was a kind of a part of his, you know, family upbringing, etc. And lots of artists do, you know, particularly painters will do printmaking, and they'll paint, you know, ceramics usually made by someone else. And that's sort of acceptable, but to have devoted your career for 30 years to ceramics, to the art world, is kind of, you know, odd.
A step below, kind
of. Yeah, that's right, and I don't know why. I can see why in some respects, if you look at the art world and the way that it's structured and the kind of opinions it has, the art world does see itself as kind of providing objects that have no...
Something that use
in some respects,
you
yes.
You couldn't put your flowers in.
Well, that's right, which, as you said, Jessica, it's like it's a step above.
But it's ironic,
the utilitarian.
The idea that something that they see as having no use is considered more valuable
exactly.
than something that does have use.
That's exactly right.
Because I would always argue that art does have function. That even art for art's sake is about, you know, exploring beauty and aesthetics and, you know, joy and all those things that you kind of... But all art is about communication, and so it's all about something.
Well, is the distinction to be made that art is something you don't touch?
Sorry?
Well, is art something you don't touch?
No,
you know, an art gallery.
No, because people to touch his pots, which we don't want.
No, we don't want them to do that to their pots. But in a sense, you know, it's perfectly acceptable to touch pots, not within the context of a gallery, but. You're not meant to touch
sculpture.
No,
it's only
the big stuff. I mean, some you
can. Well, public art's a different story. Yeah.
I fear there's two things. One, I fear that we're sort of disappearing down the wormhole of divisions between
one thing and another.
One thing and another, and you know, I'm tempted to bring up the idea that any form of communication can be interpreted as art. You know, if you want to, you can pass that as many times as you want. But I find it ironic, I've quite enjoyed both the exhibitions that we've had in this series, and you know, obviously the people who, you know, both the makers, to avoid any term whatsoever, have been incredibly gifted and talented at what they do. But I find it sort of ironic that in trying to sort of open up and, you know, declassify them as crafts people and turn them into artists, if that is indeed one of the pushes, that they then have to classify them as living treasures. And I find there's an irony there, and in a sense to me almost a desperation, which I don't understand, because what's in it for Jeff if someone calls him an artist or not? I mean, what is it? What is he going to gain? I don't think he's going to gain anything.
Yeah, it's an interesting point. I mean, it's the same issues that arose when the National Trust released its National Treasures, which was a list of writers, politicians, etc., who they deemed to be significant to Australia, and that was a really odd exercise because they were in essence endorsing these people as kind of quintessentially Australian, or you know,
should not be questioned.
Important, and that's right. And one could say the same thing's happening with this series of exhibitions, but I suppose there is a sense of not so much desperation as a kind of a commitment or need for the
greater recognition of these things.
Greater recognition, yeah. For people working within these art forms to be seen as relevant as
on
a painter.
On par with the Boyds and the,
absolutely,
you know, Nolans, yeah, of the art world.
Yeah, that's right. Because once their pots are of a, you know, significant age, they become antiquities and they are seen as art.
Mm. Yeah, which is why I'm, in a sense, sort of slightly not perturbed, but bemused by this whole struggle that these exhibitions apparently are, and the supposed, you know, resistance that the art world, you know, and I think it's almost a hidden thing. I don't know if there's anyone standing up on the sort of palisade saying, you know, Jeff Minchin, not an artist, he's too dirty and, you know, works with clay.
Yes.
You
know. Well, I think the art world has a lot to answer for in that regard.
I mean, these are like these big whisper campaigns and just a general, in a sense, almost an inertia.
Well, I
you
think...
we don't discuss them as artists.
Well, it also comes down to sort of, you know, the art world allowing people in. There's a few people that do it and, you know... One could argue that Gwyn Hanson-Piggott, who is a ceramicist and who was included in the Biennale in 2000, was sort of one that was allowed through to the upper echelons of, you know, contemporary art. She'd been working for, you know, decades within the realm of ceramics, but their inclusion in shows, their inclusions in publications, etc., will change things. These exhibitions certainly are doing a lot in terms of creating rigour around their practice. I think that the monograph that's produced to go to show is really important, and maybe more so than the shows in some respects, because...
And I think there's... I mean, not to toot our own horn or anything, but having a space in which we can show a new media work... painting, ceramics, lithographs or printmaking all at the same time gives everything an equal value and an equal weight rather than sort of dedicating certain spaces just to the crafts, which you get a lot of galleries doing and sort of separating it and just making it distinct from other things. So I think the fact that we have the ability to show crafts, as you want to call them, on the same footing as arts, make sure that people who come in don't necessarily differentiate and don't see those divisions.
Well, that's exactly right. I think that at the end of the day, the majority of the audience don't differentiate.
No, and definitely the younger audience, I don't think that there's any distinction in their mind between arts and crafts.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, I think it's interesting that, you know, every now and then we get a return to kind of honest, simple mediums, you know, painting, ceramics, weaving, you name it. And so I think that regardless of the semantics and the sort of conceptual arguments we may have, you're right, Jeff Minchin really probably doesn't care if he's referred to as an artist or not. He's a pretty successful potter who makes a career, has made a living out of making pots, and I don't think the people who buy his pots care whether he's an artist or not, or what he calls himself. So I think the way that we classify things are for a particular
audience. I think that Shona was somewhere, and the young people don't make any distinction. You know, you go through the space of people looking at Minchin, and they're not talking about them as containers. Oh, look, I need that, would be great for potatoes. You know, they're looking at them as objects of beauty that have some
form
meaning,
and colour and shape.
Meaning
and
beyond what they simply are.
That's right. I think, to look drill down further into the show, the work is extremely painterly. In the way that he is depicting the landscape in a kind of abstract way on the pots. The pots are, in a sense, a vessel for the artwork, if you like, but you can't deny the incredible skill that's gone into creating the pots themselves. They're all coil-formed, which is fine if you're making a nice round pot, but if you're making some of the pots that are in this exhibition, it's extremely difficult. So not only is he, adept at glazing, he's also an incredible artist in terms of the construction of his objects. You can't look at them without thinking of a kind of practical use for them. But in many respects, you sort of think beyond that in looking at a lot of his work. It is really about the landscape and about adapting the landscape to the language of a potter.
Mm. All right, we'll leave our discussion there. Now we'll move on to what's happening elsewhere. Recently, the sole judge of the Sulman Art Prize, Queensland artist Richard Bell, revealed that he chose the winner of the $20,000 award by tossing a coin. How do we feel about that?
Look, I was the one who sort of suggested we talk about this, and my sort of opinion of it goes backwards and forwards. First of all, I thought that it was a complete G-up and that he's just having a go at us. But then Ken Dicker told me that that's probably exactly what he did, mm-hmm. and that's what they probably knew he would do. Mm-hmm. But then you look at it again, and it's just sad. The whole thing is just sad. You know, he's trying to make a comment about, it's subjective and, you can't judge art and, whatever. I mean, the fact is that we judge everything. We judge books. We judge artworks. We judge films. We judge speeches. We judge meals. We judge everything that is subjective. You know, down to the level you go to the football, they applaud one tackle but not the other because they're judging it. Mm-hmm. And the idea that, there's some things that can't be judged, I think it's an oxymoron. It's not, because that doesn't make any sense, but it's just a good word that has moron in it. It just seems to be a really tired argument that is getting us nowhere, and that Richard Bell just comes across to me as someone who's just out there to shock us, to go, aren't I shocking, aren't I controversial, when in fact you're not. You're repeating something that someone said before and, I think has been debunked.
Yeah, I have no problem with that, though. I think that it's more boring for a bunch of people to say that the Archibald Prize is good every year, then one person maybe pointing out that art prizes, as a general rule, are problematic.
But is he pointing that out, or is... I mean,
well, I think he is.
I think he's pointing that out in a kind of obvious way that is kind of making a point that really we all kind of know.
Well, we do, but I mean, that's just as relevant as any other comment. I think that... In saying that, I think the artists would be, right in being upset about that. But at the same time, you don't engage Richard Bell without expecting...
No.
Because his art is all about that. His art is all about the shocking kind of statements about ugly versus beautiful. There's a whole host of kind of comments that he's making. I think he's making a comment also about the art world, about white art world.
Yes,
in
but
some
see,
respects.
that's the tricky thing, though, that it's okay for him to make that comment about the white art world. If that situation was reversed,
I think that
it would be a lot more controversial than just this situation that we have now.
No, I think we're at a point where people, there's a lot of comment about the Telstra Art Award and the politics that go into that as as an art award, where it sits within the Aboriginal community, where it sits within the white community, the relevance of it, what's it doing, why is a corporate entity such as Telstra you know, creating this judging Aboriginal art. So in some respects, you know, I mean, Richard Bell, you know, caused controversy at the Telstra Art Award many years ago with an offensive T-shirt that he wore. You know, there's no doubt that he is out to shock and he's out to make people think. And sometimes by, you know, by entering the realm of acceptable society, and in the case of the art world, the Sulman, or the Wynn, or the Archibald, which are kind of, you know, pillars of the respectable and acceptable face of the art world, I don't think it's fallen on deaf ears. I think that, you know, yeah, it was a bit of a stunt, but and most people will forget about it, but for that sort of little instant, he did expose it for all it is. He sort of he tried to highlight the fact that, yes, we all judge things, but at this but at the end of the day, we shouldn't be. We shouldn't be saying that that's a better artwork than that one, because there is so much more to it than any of us realise.
But the entire art world is based upon making judgments.
Absolutely.
So my concern is the fact that he's been made a shocking kind of statement, and he's drawn our attention to the sort of superficiality of art. But in doing that, he's called into question the artwork that's won and put that artist's career in the spotlight so that his career may not recover from that. I mean, granted, he's got $20,000 in the bank. Yay for him. But he will always have that knowledge that he's the artist that won based on nothing. So in that respect, I'm more than happy for Richard Bell to make really bold statements in which his own art is is the message, but doing that through somebody else's art when that's not what they want it to be, that's where I kind of have the problem with it, that it's pulling other artists into a cause that perhaps they don't want a part of.
Well, that's true.
I'm going to agree with Jess here, and I'm going to disagree with you, Ken, completely,
sure.
Because not your position was cogently argued and in some senses credible. His action had none of that. His was equally superficial, and it was just about him. It was not about he, you know, it was not him about making this great statement. It was, oh, what can I do to make sure that the Sulman, you know, one of the poorer cousins of the of the triplets, gets onto the front pages. Well, I'm going to say something, or I flipped a coin and I put it on, and that's the end of it. And for that little instant, people didn't value. I don't think they actually said, well, maybe art shouldn't be judged. They're saying art should be judged, and he didn't do his job, and he's an idiot. That's what I think the general reaction was, and that's why I'm disquieted by the entire thing.
Yeah, no, that's a valid point. I suppose the other side of it is that metaphorically, it's like a flip of a coin, that I could judge it and give Jessica the prize,
definitely.
And you could judge it and Jessica may not get the prize.
And I understand, and I think most people understand that prizes are judged subjectively, that you could have 10 different people judging something, but you at least hope that they consider it a bit more rigorously, so that they are, you know, they come to their conclusion with a bit more kind of thought behind it than just, I mean, it's not necessarily the subjectiveness of Richard Bell's decision that I have a problem with. It's the flippant, there's that kind of lack of consideration.
I don't have any problem with feeling sorry for the artist who won, and then he admitted that, because, you know, one could feel sorry for all of the artists who didn't win. Because they weren't lucky enough to have either or to have been attractive to that particular judge.
I'm not someone who particularly supports art prizes. I think the Archibald is, you know, heaping lump of a thing that needs to be put out of its misery. But I still think if we're going to run them, if we're going to have them, if we're going to go through the bother of gearing up artists to enter and to be kind of
decorum,
doing it, then an element of respect is needed somewhere in the process. Mm. We can disagree with who wins, that's fine.
Yeah.
But just to have an idea that, you know, the judges put as much thought into the judging process as the artists put into submitting the works.
Mm. All right, moving on to what's on at WPCC. Kent, can you tell us what's happening in curating?
The exhibition in the regional art space, Heather Pike and Victoria Lavecchio, will finish this Sunday, and will make way for an exhibition by a first group show to be shown in the regional art space, an exhibition called Push, by Margaret McColl, Heather Rankin, Ken Tucker, Mark Maloof, and Amanda Tout. Five artists who have been through TAFE together and have at that point in their career where they want to make that push from one aspect, I suppose, the sort of the field of kind of learning and growing into being an artist and being out in the art world. So that will be an interesting show on a number of fronts, both practically in terms of getting five artists' works to fit in that space, but also conceptually to look at the sort of areas of the world that they're exploring, etc. And that's the only show that is changing at this point.
Okay. Jess, anything in collections?
There's not a great deal happening in collections at the moment. There's a lot of data entry happening, but I will just point out for people to come and have a look at the museum on May the 18th, which is International Museums Day. So if people want to come down and spend some time in the museum and kind of think about the role that museums play in society and how valuable they are. So I just encourage everyone on May 18th to come down and have a look.
Great. In education, our outreach programs, Box of Tricks and Artwork, have commenced in schools again from last week. We started in Gilgandra and Goolma, and they went really well. We also started a new program called Blast from the Past, and that takes us into senior citizens' homes, and that also was a really positive experience and encouraged lots of discussion and lots of reminiscing, which was really positive. Also, Art 101 Module 3 with Peter Buchanan is currently underway and going really well in the darkroom. And if you're interested in darkroom photography, Module 4 is also coming up with Amy Griffiths. So if you'd like some more information on that, you can contact me and make a booking. All right, thanks everyone for joining us.
Thank you.